The World in Words
is made possible in part
by the National Endowment for the Humanities,
celebrating 50 years of excellence.
Nina, why did you learn the Romanian language?
Because I lived there in Romania for 2 years. So it was sort of de facto.
Oh, you learned it sort of on the go?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you learned for very practical reasons.
Yeah,
you learned because you were living there and you had to... Yeah.
Well, what about you in Danish? Why did you learn Danish?
Because it wasn't French. And not that I have anything against French, but I studied French for a long time at high school. And the plan that my parents thought when I went off to college was that I would study French language and literature. And I'd spend my year abroad, as one does in England, in France. And I'm like, I don't want to go and live in France for a year. I really don't. I've been to France a lot and I just didn't want to. I wanted to go somewhere new. Hmm? And Danish was available that you could learn from scratch.
So it's like a brand new language you decided yourself.
I was very much establishing my own identity.
Take that, parents. I'm going to learn Danish. Wow, so we both learned these languages for kind of interesting reasons.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, certainly not the usual ones that you hear, like for love or...
Or that it's like a heritage language, like, you know, my grandparents spoke this language or,
right.
or anything like that.
We didn't even do it for the money.
Kind of.
Did you make a lot of money in Romania?
No, not at all. I made about $100 a month, but but it was my source of income.
Okay, so you may think that we, Nina and me, were a little out of the ordinary in our language learning choices, and I suppose in a way we are. But today on The World in Words, we offer proof that there really are a limitless number of reasons why people learn languages. And here's the evidence. It's provided by Jennifer Cronovet.
In the summer of 2000, I set out to learn Yiddish. I didn't want to learn the language so that I might someday speak it. Instead, I had one specific goal, to translate Yiddish poetry. I was a young graduate student studying poetry in the Midwest and had received a grant to come back to my hometown of New York City and spend the summer in an intensive Yiddish program. I would attend several hours of language class a day, followed by activities in Yiddish, put on by YIVO, an organization that preserves Yiddish history. After I studied Yiddish, I imagined, I would go on to translate the Yiddish poetry that had been written during the first half of the 20th century. During that time in New York City, there had been a thriving Yiddish literary scene of secular Jews trying to find ways to write about a changing world.
Levone, levone, du bist da so schön.
Yiddish was in my blood. My paternal grandparents had spoken it, although never to my father. And I hoped that once I learned Yiddish, I would find a poet writing what my grandmother would have written if she'd been a poet. She was an incisive woman, thoughtful and imaginative, and not at all the stereotype of the Yiddish grandmother, residing in the kitchen surrounded by many children. I didn't admit it to myself then, but it is clear to me now that in hoping to find my grandmother in the poetry of the past, I was also hoping to find myself, my own voice buried inside a buried tongue. Deciding to learn a language just to translate from that language is a ridiculous gamble. What if you invest months, or more likely years, in learning a language and then don't find work that speaks to you? And why translate poetry in the first place? Translation is an art often deemed impossible, doomed to failure. The chance that I would translate a book was low. The chance that someone would actually read that book was much lower. But in the year 2000, I wasn't thinking of the impracticalities of my plan. I had already chosen to be a poet, the least practical of occupations. And as a poet, I'd given myself over to language itself, to trying to find out everything I could about how to communicate what is most difficult to say. I was also somehow under the impression that because my family had spoken Yiddish, it would come naturally to me. But on the very first day of class, I could see that wasn't true. Yiddish is hard. Yiddish has almost all of the complex grammar of German, three genders, several cases, complicated adjectival endings, but with some extra Slavic grammar thrown in for fun. It accumulates humor by moving between Germanic words and Hebrew ones, which is not at all funny when you can't read the Hebrew words because they follow a different spelling system. Learning a language for me, and as far as I can tell, for most people other than a few annoying naturals, is a painstaking affair. By the end of the first week, I'd accumulated a stack of flashcards and could almost say a tiny bit about myself. There was a long road ahead, a road filled with conjugations and declensions, with many dictionary pit stops and false cognate pitfalls along the way. In those first few weeks of class, I would hear a word, let's say the word for potato, kartoffel, and feeling laden with new vocabulary, I would question whether I really needed to learn that word and its gender. I mean, how many modernist poems have potatoes in them, or tubers of any kind, or vegetables, period? But that was a dangerous line of thought. As a poet, I knew that I could never know what words would show up in a poem. All of language is fair game in poetry, even language that might seem too functional or edible. A few weeks into the program, an optional translation workshop was offered. This was my chance to try my hand at what I came there to do. I went to the library and spent hours in the stacks. Flipping through Yiddish books, I felt like I was trying to hear someone talking underwater. The words were there, I could look each one up, but I was still way too far away from fluency to access the pleasure I knew in opening a book of poetry and falling into a poem. This felt more like drowning than reading. Finally, I opened a book to a poem that I believed I might almost understand.
Ich bin der Trunkene. In a tiefen Brunnen.
It was short, and it was written in tercets, each stanza a room containing a thought that I might contain in English. I spent a week translating that short poem and seeing what I could find out about the poet, Celia Dropkin. Dropkin was born in what is now Belarus in 1887. She moved to New York in 1912, following her husband. He was an activist for the Bund, a Jewish workers' rights movement, who had fled torture by coming to the U.S. She'd written poems in Russian before, but was so inspired by the Yiddish writing scene in New York that she began writing in Yiddish, which was also a native language to her. She came to be associated with the otherwise all-male Yiddish writing movement, the introspectivists, and published poems and short stories. Even though she was a part of Yiddish literary life, she was heavily criticized for her bodily, sexual, and personal work. She had 6 children, 5 of whom survived, and she died in 1956. Could this be the one, I asked myself, reading her biography, as if I were searching for a ghost soulmate and not a poet to translate? I knew that I wanted to translate a woman, writing in her own way during a time when so few women did. But as a reader and a writer, I stayed away from poetry that came off as overly confessional or juicy. I didn't believe that the meaning I was looking for was held in the details of the body. Instead, I was experimenting with a kind of distance that put language at the forefront and not my life. And she'd had so many children. Would Dropkin turn out to be the cliché of the Yiddish grandmother I was trying to rewrite? In the poem I tried to translate, the speaker is stuck in a well, and she can't scrape her way out.
Die verschimmelte Brunnen wend seinen glitschig, und meine Hände verlieren die Kraft.
Someone is standing above her, maybe. Did he push her in the well? If not, why won't he save her? Is there actually a person or just the sky? The well walls are too slippery for the drowning woman to grip, and that is how the poem felt to me as well. After working on the poem, I still wasn't convinced Dropkin was the girl for me. The poem was so emotive, dripping with longing and anger and despair. One might think that poets are all about longing and anger and despair, but I wanted to hold those feelings down for inspection, not leak them all over the page. Dropkin's drowning poem was, to me, unseemly. I didn't know then that it was one of the most staid she'd ever written. Despite my concerns over Dropkin herself, I did enjoy the process of translation. I liked going from word to word, like leaping from stone to stone across a creek. I could feel English under my grip, my muscles as a writer trying to match Dropkin's brash tone. I enjoyed the questions translation brought up about the differences between languages and if they could be breached. Even if I don't choose Dropkin as a poet to translate, I thought, at least I've found translation here this summer. The workshop was not as bad as I expected it to be. Perhaps because Yiddishists happen to be among the nicest, most supportive people on earth. And the day after the workshop, two advanced students.
I'm Faith Jones.
My name is Sam Solomon.
Came up to me with a proposition. The three of us would team up to translate Dropkin's work together. Without giving it much consideration, I said yes. Two people had seen something in Dropkin's work that they found to be worth their time. Maybe this meant I would too. And Sam and Faith were very good at Yiddish. I needed all the help I could get. We made a plan. After the summer course, we would divide up the poems Dropkin had written, about 150 of them. Each of us would make rough translations of our share, and we'd meet up again in a year to see what we'd missed. Back then, Sam was a teenager.
I was still at high school. I had one more year coming along.
And Faith was a librarian for the New York Public Library.
I turned 35 that summer.
There was a decade between each of us, and I was in the middle. We didn't know each other very well, and certainly wouldn't have guessed how long we'd work together on this one project and what it would come to mean to us.
After the break, Jennifer Cronovitz's story continues. Okay, we have a recommendation now for...
another nerdy language podcast.
That's right. Have you heard Lingthusiasm? Can you say Lingthusiasm?
Lingthusiasm. It always trips me up for some reason. But it is Gretchen McCulloch and...
Lauren Gawne.
It's a really fun listen, especially if you're really nerdy about language.
These guys actually know something about language.
They're
actually
real
trained.
Linguists.
They're not like us. They really know what they're talking about.
They really
Like when we're in trouble on this front, we interview a linguist.
Right.
They just think.
Okay, so their latest episode is about discourse markers.
What the heck is a discourse?
I have no idea.
Oh, right. See, we've got to listen.
Why they're the real experts. Yeah.
By the end of this episode, you're going to know all about discourse markers. And presumably, there are some great stories behind them.
Right. So, Lingthusiasm.
You said it.
Yes.
Lingthusiasm. Check it out wherever you listen to podcasts.
Apple Podcasts, Stitcher.
And now back to Jennifer Cronovitz.
There's a Yiddish saying, Werter soll men wegen und nicht zählen, which translates as, words should be weighed and not counted. Yet, that first year of trying to translate Dropkin's poems, I did a lot of both. I tried to attack the shorter poems first, as if they would be easier, and not as they were, more condensed and metaphorical and sharp, more in need of tuned attention. That first year of counting and weighing words, I calculated that I was far out of my league. My Yiddish was not up to the task of even getting down a basic summary of the experience of reading a Dropkin poem, and maybe, I thought at points, not even my English was up to the task. That first year, working alone, I made my way through three or four poems. I could feel a heat under the words of the poetry, but at a great distance that my English couldn't touch. That next summer, I moved back to New York and took another intensive Yiddish course. Upon regrouping, and with my Yiddish slightly better than before, Sam, Faith, and I made a more realistic plan. We would get together every few weeks to go over a handful of poems. I started to settle into my adult life. I had a job, my writing, a boyfriend, and I had Sam, Faith, and Celia. I found myself looking forward to meeting to go over our translations, but often I realized I was just looking forward to seeing Sam and Faith. We usually met at Faith's apartment. She was older and her life was more stable than mine, a model for a life I hoped I could have. She and her wife lived in a cozy apartment in Brooklyn, and they'd created a community around themselves of friends who cared about books and Yiddish.
I think I turned into mom.
Faith always reminded us to take breaks, to eat her delicious and hearty snacks, because the brain too is a muscle.
I'm not good when I'm hungry, so... I guess that turned into one of my recurring roles, or maybe it was a recurring joke, I'm not sure.
As a librarian, she also made sure that a bevy of dictionaries was in easy reach. Snacks and dictionaries, a perfect combination. In fact, I would say that if anyone is going to undertake a long project with someone, choose a librarian. Faith kept track of everything, of what we did know and, more importantly, what we didn't. She was our detective, finding words we couldn't define, hiding out in other languages, and finding people to help us hiding out across North America. Faith made sure there was continuity in our work with her Excel spreadsheets, and she also connected our work to others. She reached out to Dropkin's family to let them know that we cared about Dropkin's work. She kept in contact with these relatives, forming relationships with them. At one point, Faith organized a visit to one of Celia's sons, John.
And it turned out that he lived a few blocks from me in Brooklyn.
He was in his 90s. My mother, he said with great pride and a hint of deviousness, was a true bohemian.
Dropkin wrote these erotic poems and poems that were very ambivalent about motherhood. And he found none of those things odd or off-putting.
I'd never heard anyone talk about their mother that way. Sam had grown up going to Yiddish classes as a child and was born into a Yiddish culture in New York I had thought was gone and buried.
And I was interested in poetry. I was in sort of high school literary magazine and wrote and did things like that.
Sam saw Yiddish as a living language, and so he approached Dropkin's poems with an openness to all that life can offer.
I was really excited by them.
Sam, as a high school student, and then as a college student, and then as a graduate student, didn't come to Dropkin with a limiting imagination of who Dropkin should be. He was thrilled by who she was. At first, I mistook Sam's amazing openness for youth. But as we grew up together with Dropkin, I came to see that Sam approached all of life this way. Through the years of translating Dropkin, Sam was the one who argued most passionately to stay true to Dropkin's Yiddish.
Because her Yiddish is very spare, it's not especially full of jokey idioms or things that people associate with Yiddish in America.
Mein Mame, a 22 Jorica, an Almone mit zwei kleinige Kinder geblieben.
As close as Sam and Faith and I grew through our work, I still kept a distance between me and Dropkin. I was afraid to touch the poems too closely. They were so over the top. In them, a mother's lust spurts out of the daughter.
Jetzt spritzt von mir offen mein Mames heißer, heiliger, tief verbehaltener Bagger.
A woman becomes impregnated with her own lover.
Du hast nicht verzeta Kind in mir, nor hast verzeta sich allein.
A woman breastfeeds her lover.
Stiel dein Hunger, dein Durst auf mein Brust.
Sucks her lover's blood, is devoured by the fat worm of passion.
Und der Vetterwurm, Leidenschaft.
A mother lets her daughter cry in the distance as she tries to ignore the wails.
Mich hat dort gerufen mein kleines Kind.
I was afraid that Dropkin would infect my own poetry with drama. Deep down, I wondered if I was wasting my time trying to translate a writer who, at best, wrote the poetic equivalent of schmaltzy, trashy romance novels, and that no matter how hard we worked, we would never be able to make this poetry palatable to today's readers in English. Despite my misgivings about Dropkin, I kept working.
Welcome, welcome, my guest. Lay down the burden of your life. Undress, rest.
I owed it to Sam and Faith, and I also couldn't imagine stepping away from what had become a wonderful part of my life.
Sate your hunger, your thirst, at my breast, at my breast.
My lack of faith in Dropkin didn't challenge my enthusiasm for the art of translation. The poems that influenced me most, I read in translation. These poems blew my mind, expanded my understanding of poetry and language itself. Translations brought me out of American literature and into a global conversation, opening a portal to voices across the world. I read avidly about the process of translation, the seemingly impossible journey from one language to another. These essays often read like several genres rolled into one. A travelogue crossed with a mystery, crossed with a fairy tale, occasionally crossed with a thriller. In 2003, I started a magazine for poetry and translation with a friend to try to remedy the lack of opportunities for translators to publish in the U.S. It was painful to me that my own translation project was so fraught with doubt. In 2005, we finished rough translations of every single poem that Celia Dropkin had ever written, and then we put her away. Faith moved back to her native Canada, Sam moved to California and then to England as a professor. I moved to China and back. I got married, I published my first book of poetry, and then I had a son. When I was pregnant with my daughter, my family and I moved to the Midwestern city where I'd first tried to translate Dropkin in order to teach at the university where I'd studied. Although I loved teaching poetry, I found myself searching out work that directly spoke to my life, which wasn't easy to find. I wanted to read poetry that captured the ambivalence of motherhood, the complexities of having a changing body that contained desire and violence and everything in between. In my own writing, I felt trapped behind a wall of cliches, like the true messiness and depth of life was beyond the reach of language. The more lost I felt as a writer, the more Dropkin crossed my thoughts. I'd experience a sensation I could recognize because Dropkin had described it. I could feel her sometimes beneath my writing when I was trying to say something both impossible and true. Maybe, I wondered, Dropkin hadn't truly been as trashy as I thought. Maybe I'd miss something. One night, for the first time in 5 years, I opened up our old Dropkin files.
My lithe body, barely touching the blades.
I read the poems again, and they felt completely new to me. The over-the-top personal images were still there, of course. But now, instead of being turned off by them, I recognized myself. Dropkin took familiar images for love, for sex, for motherhood, the same images I felt stuck inside as a writer, and she pushed them to the extreme.
I'm tired of dancing between you, cold steel daggers. I want my blood warming your bare tips to fall.
The results were the chaotic, lustful, disappointed, terrifying, and thrilling thoughts of a mother like me. When I first started reading Dropkin, so much had stood between me and her. Time, language, almost all of the details of our lives. I hadn't been able to hear her through those differences or strip away the stereotypes that came with them. But older now and hitting against the expectations of my own time, I was finally able to appreciate the messy extremity of Dropkin's poems. Life is, I had come to see, quite messy and extreme. To write out of that was no longer unseemly to me, but radical and true. In one poem, Dropkin wrote about her mother's suppressed desire and longing.
But all of the days and years and nights of sighs, sighs from her youth and tenderness, from her longing blood.
Dropkin soaked that longing up. And now, Dropkin wrote, her holy latent lust spurts frankly from me. This line had been so icky to me the first time I read it, but now I admired it. The lust was sexual, of course, but also sacred, and it took form in words. Dropkin took the buried lust of generations and gave it voice. Would my grandmother have written like this? The truth is, I'd never considered my grandmother's latent lusts. Maybe she would have, and maybe not. My relationship with Dropkin taught me that I couldn't guess at the interior life of others. That's how vast and complex people in all times are. But luckily, with Dropkin, I don't have to guess. I still have her words.
Like juicy red apples, my cheeks flare up in the sun with a crimson flame.
After rereading the poems, I went back to work. Sam, Faith, and I spent another year going over the translations.
And when someone, dazzled by my red cheeks, lifts me up from the dirt, he then tosses me aside with disgust and pity because my heart is eaten up by the worms.
I felt like I was translating the work for so many people, for Dropkin herself and for her family, for all of Dropkin's future readers who might need her as much as I did. But I was also translating the poems for the younger me, who hadn't been able to see how amazing and contemporary these poems are. I wanted to show her. I thought that Dropkin would bring me closer to my own history and voice, but she became a part of my history. And I have become a part of hers. In 2014, the first book of Dropkin's work in English was published in the U.S. The book has her poems in Yiddish, too. You can see the two languages speaking to each other across the spine. Many years ago, I stopped studying Yiddish. I continue to study Mandarin and German, have lived in China twice, and am living in Germany now. Those two languages are a part of my life in a daily way that Yiddish can never be. In the end, I studied Yiddish just to have one conversation, a conversation with the dead. It's a conversation that gave me a family beyond blood and a new sense of language, how impossibly large one tongue can be, and how even one life inside that language can expand what can be said. Although I would never say that I learned Yiddish, I hope that in the years of talking with Dropkin, of wrestling with her, of dancing with her, of drowning with her, I've earned the honor to be among those who speak for her.
Jennifer Cronovet. The selection of Celia Dropkin poems she translated with Faith Jones and Sam Solomon is called The Acrobat. And Jennifer's latest collection of her own poems is called The Wug Test.
The Wug Test. What is the Wug Test, Patrick? Is that a linguistics thing?
Yeah, it's a linguistics thing. It's like discourse markers. I looked it up. It's a test, the Wug Test, that it was developed decades ago to assess language acquisition in kids. It mixes up real words with the odd fake word.
And the kids have to, like, discern what is real and what is fake?
I don't think so. I think that what the testers are trying to do is to see what kind of grammatical patterns the kids follow.
Huh.
Whether or not they're being prompted to use real or fake words. I may have that completely wrong because,
who is Wug? Is
like
Wug,
I say, I'm not a linguist.
Is Wug the person who created it, or is Wug actually a fake word?
Yeah, Wug is a fake word. And because Jenny's poems, they refer to the Wug test and various other linguistic theories and ideas, that is actually why we got talking, Jenny and I got talking in the first place about collaborating on a podcast. But the poems, they're great, and not just about linguistics. They're all about love and childhood and being a parent and all sorts of other things. Well, that is it for the pod today. We have show notes with photos of pretty much everyone you heard today. That's at pri.org/language.
And because this is a Patrick-hosted podcast, we do have a lot of people to thank in this podcast.
I love to thank.
He loves to thank. First and most importantly, we want to thank Tina Toby, who mixed today's episode. Also, Louis Cronin, Robin Moore, Mike Wilkins, who also help us mix and engineer, and everyone else at the World Radio Program.
Of which this podcast is an offshoot. Also, thanks to the BBC, our co-producer, for archive audio. Also, for use of their studios in Berlin and Brighton in the UK. We really got around for this one. And to the CBC for use of their studios in Vancouver. A big, big thanks to Tanya Larkin, who read the translated poems, the English versions. Tanya, by the way, is a poet herself. She's published two collections. The most recent is called My Scarlet Ways.
Don't forget to leave us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. It really helps other people hear about us.
And just in case you're wondering what Celia Dropkin herself sounded like, here she is. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon.
Ein Liebebrief, ich will lernen, sie mit zum Schreiben. Ein Liebebrief, die Wurzeln von Pflanzen der Liebe wachsen im Herz, meinem Tief. Eine wilde und stechige Pflanze, verweht von herbstigem Wind. Ach, sie ist kein Pflanzen, mein Liebe, sie ist ein Nefisch und nackt und blind. Mit Blut und mit Lärm eine Pflanze, wie es wartet sich, wie es weint und wie schreit. Rachmone sich sucht mit dem Achel, die Brust, was ist Täter der Weib, das hungrig, nefisch Liebe, wart sich und wehn bis wird schwarz. Wer hat es verseht und geboren, wer nockt es und reißt mir mein Herz. Ich will werden sie mit zum Schreiben, ein Liebebrief.
The World in Words
is made possible in part
by the National Endowment for the Humanities,
celebrating 50 years of excellence.